This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good morning and welcome to Locust Focus. I'm your host, Barbara Bernstein, and this morning we're talking about the dirtiest source of gas that we put in our cars here in the Northwest. In these end days of peak oil, the Canadian province of Alberta is on a mission to replace Saudi Arabia as the world's major source of petroleum. The once pristine boreal forests of northern Alberta are being transformed into gigantic pit mines as energy companies rush to extract some of the last of the Earth's petroleum reserves. The quest to extract and refine the thick, dirty tar sands that lie beneath what was once a wilderness of wetlands and salmon-rich rivers threatens the ecology and economy of North America. This morning, we're talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, a journalist based in Calgary, Alberta, whose award-winning book, Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, exposes this disaster in the making. Andrew Nikiforuk is an award-winning author and investigative journalist. Over the past two decades, he's written about energy, economics, and the West for a variety of Canadian publications, including Maclean's, Canadian Business, The Globe and Mail, and Reader's Digest. Welcome to Locust Focus.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Barbara.
Well, until recently, the extraction of oil from the tar sands of northern Alberta seemed to be a pretty well-kept secret, at least here below the 49th parallel. Last year, shortly before your book came out, I read a pretty scary article in The New Yorker, I think it was by Elizabeth Colbert, about how that part of Alberta has been transformed into a vast industrialized wasteland. Your book gives a more detailed and in-depth picture of what's going on for what's been going on for at least a couple of decades. So why has it taken so long for this story to go public down here?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think a lot of it really has to do with the fact that the average consumer of oil doesn't really think much about where it's coming from. And there's a fair degree of illiteracy about energy in general. Most Canadians are not aware that Canada is now the number one supplier of oil to the United States. And most Americans aren't aware that, you know, 20% of their oil is coming from Canada. And of that 20%, at least 13 to 14% is coming directly from the tar sands. And this has happened over the last 10 years. It's been a rather a dramatic change. But, you know, it's one of these kind of quiet things that sort of happens insidiously and without much debate. And it's something that industry has promoted. Industry thinks, rightly or wrongly, that we can move from light oil, from conventional oil sources, and make this transition to heavy oil or bitumen in the tar sands without affecting business as usual. When in fact, when you start making this transition, I mean, business as usual is over. I mean, the rapid development of the tar sands is perhaps the most dramatic signature you can find anywhere on the planet that peak oil is here and has arrived.
Well, actually, I remember when I read the article in The New Yorker, there was a very graphic photograph of what the tar sand pits look like. And when I was looking for some pictures last night to put on our website, I think these pictures are far more prevalent than they were when a picture appeared in The New Yorker. And it's a very devastating image that, when I think people see that, maybe something can connect about what we're doing every time we put some gas in our car here in the Northwest that came from the bitumen.
Yeah, one of Canada's chief economists, a fellow by the name of Jeff Rubin, he used to work for one of our major banks, CIBC, has made the comment, look, when you have to schlep 2 tons of sand to produce 1 barrel of oil, you know you're at the bottom of the ninth inning. And that's what an increasing number of, I think, of American consumers have to think about. I mean, you have arguments for getting off bloody oil from the Middle East, but then the arguments for getting hooked then and or increasingly addicted to dirty oil from Canada breaks down. It's kind of like, in many ways, it's like switching your mortgage from Bear Stearns to Countrywide Financial. You still have a serious problem at the end of the day, and in this case, that's the America's fundamental addiction to oil as the energy that kind of greases the economy. The liabilities associated with this are extreme. Number one, I mean, this is this really is one of the world's most expensive hydrocarbons. You know, it can't be produced for less than $60 to $80 a barrel on average. So that's a warning number one to Americans that, you know what, you can't run on this stuff for long. Two is the carbon intensity of the product. I mean, properly speaking, bitumen is you know, looks like asphalt, smells like asphalt, and behaves like asphalt. So it takes an enormous amount of energy to upgrade it and then put it through a complex refinery.
So it's kind of like if we were going to take our roads and turn them into oil to put in our
that's
car.
That's right, yeah. You're kind of reversing geology here, and so that's really energy intensive. So as a consequence, then, the production of this oil is 2 to 3 times more carbon intensive than light oil. And then, you know, the other major footprint here is the use of water. It takes about 12 barrels of fresh water to produce one barrel of bitumen. And in the process, three of those barrels become toxic wastewater that end up in tailings ponds. And that's just for one form of production. That's the open pit mining, which is, you know, like open pit mining in Appalachia or anywhere else. It's ugly and it's an earth-destroying economy. And so those kind of liabilities are and extreme costs of production are, you know, becoming the focus of more and more debate in the United States, as they should. And Americans have really have to begin to ask some serious questions about this. And it's interesting who's kind of leading the charge here. In many ways, the U.S. military has led the charge on this debate.
And how is that?
Well, the U.S. military has taken home some pretty hard lessons from Iraq. I mean, they discovered that really, in the field, about 10% of the fighting force is doing all the fighting, but has to be constantly re-equipped with fossil fuel to keep it in the front. And so 90% of your force then is essentially a supply train, a petroleum supply train. And what the U.S. military discovered in Iraq was how vulnerable that supply train is to insurgent attacks or improvised explosive devices. So what you began to see in Iraq was the greening of the U.S. military, and that a lot of generals, a lot of admirals, you know, came to the conclusion that they have to really substantially reduce their dependency on fossil fuels. And they brought that lesson back to the United States. Many military bases are now really ramping up their investments in renewables.
Well, I want to take this discussion about tar sands in northern Alberta back to kind of its inception of as a concept of where the U.S. could get its energy from, and talk about Herman Kahn, who I have my own little Herman Kahn story before we get into how he's affected the oil sands story. Mm-hmm. But a number of years ago, I had an opportunity to interview him a few years before he died, and right. I was trying to hide the fact that I was kind of like this hippie, progressive, radical counterculture journalist. So I, you know, wore a dress and things like that when I went out to meet him. But this, the fact that I was from Portland, Oregon, and the fact I think I wore Birkenstocks completely blew my cover. So he started going on about just how completely misled the Northwest was. And one of his biggest gripes of the Northwest was how Vancouver had the potential to have the best deep water port in the world. It could rival Hong Kong, he said, but they're so foolish, they don't want to develop it. They want to preserve the environment. And then when I was reading your book and saw that he was behind the first visions of how to create this tar sands empire in northern Alberta, I thought, well, that sounds like the same Herman Kahn who wanted to blow up and dynamite the harbor in Vancouver and turn it into a major deep water port and destroy all the natural amenities of the area. So let's talk a little bit about Herman Kahn and what his vision was, because a lot of people associate him perhaps mainly with helping us think the unthinkable, that nuclear war could be fun and profitable, at least for some of his friends. But how does that connect to his whole relationship to the tar sands in Alberta?
Well, I mean, Herman Kahn, who is, you know, he's quite the character, and was, you know, associated with the Hudson Institute and also with the Rand Institute for much of his life, had a number of radical solutions that he came up with in the 1970s. You know, and this was for the first oil shock, right? So this is when the United States had to wrestle with the fact that it didn't have enough domestic oil to meet demand, and had to make this switch to Mideast oil, which it did without much of a conversation. And so Kahn, you know, entered that debate and said, you know what, guys, you know, there's this huge deposit in northern Canada, and why don't we just go up there and develop the heck out of it, and let's take, you know, a whole bunch of money from Japan and Korea and Europe and the United States, and we'll invest millions, billions in this project, and we'll sort of create energy security for North America by more or less, you know, globalizing production of this resource, and sort of create this kind of international oil production zone in Canada, and then the United States would have a secure supply of oil. And at the time, the Canadian government entertained the idea. They said, well, you know, this is a fantastic idea, Herman, but they sort of concluded that, you know, the pollution costs, the economic costs, I mean, they thought it would pretty much undo the Canadian economy, would be so extreme that they said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. But funny enough, really what Kahn envisioned in the 1970s has really happened back in the 1990s, where we had rapid development of the resource led by multinational companies and state-owned oil companies from around the world. And we've now reached levels of production that, you know, that would even have surprised Kahn, and with a level of investment much higher than what Kahn even forecast, you know, around $200 billion. So it is the world's largest energy project, and it all came to pass as a result of free market forces, as opposed to Kahn's attempt to really to get the American government to kickstart the whole thing with a massive investment of $8 to $10 billion.
I'm talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, who is a journalist and author of a book that just came out last year called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. And we're talking about the extensive oil sands mining operation in northern Alberta and how it's transforming our continent and perhaps the world economy. And we'll get into some of the problems with sustainability in a little bit. But I'm still kind of thinking about Herman Kahn's vision for Vancouver, and I think Vancouver is a part of Canada that a lot of people in the Northwest are probably a bit more familiar with than Fort McMurray, Alberta. But I'm thinking that if Kahn's vision of Vancouver had happened, that the very beautiful city that still has great views of the Lyons and the Georgia Strait, and you, even though it's developed a lot since the time when Herman Kahn was talking to me, it's still a very beautiful natural place. And if people could imagine that being a totally industrialized seaport on the level of Hong Kong, and then transpose that to northern Alberta and to these amazing wilderness forests that are no longer, can you talk a little bit about what Kahn's vision, and then actually what has transpired, how it's transformed the landscape of northern Alberta?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When Kahn came up with his proposal to push the rapid development of the tar sands in the 1970s, I mean, everyone at that time, too, was thinking about another resource in the United States, and that was the oil shale in Colorado and Utah. And Kahn thought, you know, well, that's not such a good idea. We'd be really ripping up all this beautiful foothills country in the Rocky Mountains, you know, outside of Denver and so on, and that would be pretty noticeable, and that would make a hell of a mess. But the boreal forest, what was the boreal forest? Well, it was just kind of this muskeg, mosquito-bitten place, and nobody would notice it, so why don't we just sacrifice that area? And that was sort of Kahn's idea. And, you know, and what has happened, it really is, it is a tremendous sacrifice. I mean, the government of Alberta is essentially proposing to industrialize an area the size of Florida in northern Alberta. And we have already set aside an area of about 3,000 square kilometers for open pit mining. And we have set aside, you know, other areas about the size of Delaware or Maryland for in situ production, or what I call the steam plants. So you've got the very shallow deposits of bitumen, which can be reached with open pit mining, and many of these mines are the size of cities. I mean, the Curl Lake project, for example, will be slightly smaller than the entire area occupied by the city of Seattle. That's 70 square miles. And but the steam plants will be, you know, fragmenting a forest over much greater area. You know, the well pad, they look, you know, they have a footprint similar to conventional oil and gas drilling.
Now let's talk a little bit about the as you're calling them, the shallow pit mining, and then the in situ. What is that process, and why is it so much more devastating than the already devastating strip mining that's been going on?
Well, you mean why is the open pit mining more devastating?
Well, you're talking about the in situ, which I think is a little bit of a harder concept to grasp. What does that mean, and what does that do? I mean, obviously, the open pit mining is as an obvious problem in terms of environmental consequences, but I got the sense from reading your book that the in situ process is even more destructive.
Absolutely. Okay, well, about 60% of the stuff being produced now is coming from the open pit mines, but within short order, within 10 years, the majority of everything will come from these steam plants. And so most of the resource is really too deep and under the forest floor to be open pit mined. So we've come up a system where you take lots of groundwater, you boil it up with natural gas, you convert it to steam, you inject the steam, and then you melt these deposits of bitumen, much the same way you would melt a block of wax, and then you collect the bitumen and then you bring it back up to surface. Now there are a whole bunch of issues here. First is land fragmentation of the forest, and so you're really fragmenting the boreal forest with pipelines and well pads and these steam plants. And the next issue is the phenomenal use of groundwater, about 3 barrels to produce 1 barrel of bitumen. And we really don't have any good data on how we're affecting groundwater flow in the region as a result. And the third issue are the carbon emissions. This whole process is 2 to 3 times more carbon intensive than the open pit mining is, as well as you've also got problems with air pollution, and you're really making an acid rain problem from this process. So this is a highly destructive form of oil extraction that will essentially affect a much greater area than the open pit mining will, because the open pit mines are all located in one sort of area just north of Fort McMurray. And will essentially, in the end, destroy an area about the size of New York. But the steam plants could effectively really industrialize a forest the size of Florida over time.
Well, besides the environmental consequences, which are pretty dire, you also talk about the social and economic and, I guess, political consequences, but let's talk a little bit about how the area around Fort McMurray has been transformed as a result of the tar sands exploration.
Well, Fort McMurray was at one time kind of your typical, northern Canadian mining community. And, until the 1990s, it was essentially a town with two major open pit mines that were producing bitumen, with a population of around 30,000 folks. But with this bitumen boom, that community has been literally turned upside down, and we now have a population of anywhere between 80 and 90,000 people. We've got anywhere between 15 to 25,000 people in bush camps where new mining projects are under construction. And these guys are coming from all over the United States and Canada and Europe and Asia. Many of them are foreign temporary workers to take part in this boom. And then we have all the problems, all the moral carelessness that one associates with a boom. So we have, incredible housing issues. We've got crack cocaine and drug issues in the community of Fort Mac. We've got, escort services like you wouldn't believe, gone from one page in the yellow pages to 14.
What do you mean by escort services? It's kind of like black water.
Well, they're essentially prostitutes for all the single guys working in the bush, and so these gals again are coming from all across the continent.
So this is kind of like the lower 48, more like California in the West in the mid 19th century with the first gold rushes and silver rushes.
Yeah, very much so, or even with the California's oil boom in the 1920s and 30s, Louisiana's oil boom in the 1920s and 30s, the Texas boom, the Oklahoma boom. You find the same sort of phenomenon where you've got, lots of money focused in one place and lots of young men making lots of cash. And then, you have the prostitutes, the drugs, the alcoholism, the suicide, the housing issues, and all the cons that go on with it. You know, it's in the United States, it's been called the sublet syndrome, you know, based on coal and other hydrocarbon booms in places like Wyoming, and, you know, where you've got all of this activity producing all of these kind of dislocated transient workforce that totally uproots the local community. And, you know, it's difficult to get a doctor, it's difficult to get medical services, it's difficult to find housing. You've got people who are all there to for the money, and you've got a whole bunch of people in town making a killing as opposed to making a living.
And then there were people that used to live there, I mean, who've been there for generations, and also I understand it's like at the edge of a tribal community as well. So what's the interaction like between the people who've been there a long time and these newcomers?
Well, you get a real tension, you know, between you know, the stickers and the boomers. You've got, you know, people who are there to build community are you know, wondering what the hell's going on, and then you've got people there just to make a dollar who don't really care about putting anything back into the community. They're all there to take as much as they can, as fast as they can, and then to get the hell out of there. So you have incredible tension then between these two groups. Those that are really intent on building some kind of community over the long term, and those who have no interest in any community whatsoever. And you see these kind of, you know, debates, you know, throughout the Southwest in the United States too, whether it's Garfield County in Colorado or Sublette County in Wyoming, wherever you've had hydrocarbon booms, and in this case it's, you know, it's mostly natural gas, rapid natural gas extraction that has created these booms. But you've created the same sort of culture and the same kind of tension between stickers and boomers.
Well, we're talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, who's the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. And we're talking about the practices of extracting tar sands from northern Alberta and the impact that it's having not just locally in that part of Canada, but throughout North America. We are talking about all the uses of energy that are necessary to extract the tar sands, and it sounds like some of them, like natural gas, are actually going to be running out rather soon, maybe before the tar sands runs out. So in your book, you mentioned nuclear power as an option. I wonder if you can talk about the plans for using nuclear power to help extract tar sands and what you see some of the problems being with that.
Okay, well, actually, let's deal with the natural gas issue first. It's a phenomenal amount of natural gas being used. About 20% of Canada's demand is all going to the tar sands every year. Every day we burn enough natural gas up there to heat 6 million Canadian homes. We're not going to run out of natural gas shortly, largely due to this new unconventional gas plays going on in the United States and Canada, where we've, you know, you're fracking deep formations and producing enormous amounts of unconventional gas, which has its own environmental footprint, very high in energy intensity and water intensity. But there have been a number of proposals in the tar sands to limit the use of natural gas. And as a result, we have three proposals for nuclear power plants. And the idea is to replace natural gas as a fuel stock in the tar sands, as fuel that's used to power the steam plants, or as a source of energy for running some of the mining operations, or for upgrading the bitumen. In many cases, natural gas is used. You crack the natural gas, you take out the hydrogen, and they use the hydrogen to enrich bitumen to upgrade it to something called synthetic crude. So, I mean, the natural gas demands are phenomenal. So to replace all of that, you know, we've got these proposals for nuclear power plants, which is rather extraordinary, because then, you know, Canada would end up being the first country in the world to use nuclear power, not to get off fossil fuels, but to accelerate their production in the tar sands.
And what do you think are some of the problems with using nuclear power, period, or particularly using them in relation to tar sands?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues. First of all, first and foremost, is an economic issue. I think, you know, it is, you know, there's talk of a renaissance, but I think the financial recession has pretty much killed this renaissance in nuclear power, because it is not terribly economic. Secondly, you know, nuclear power does come with its own carbon footprint, and it would be substantial here, and because, you know, you're producing a lot of carbon when you're mining uranium and then upgrading it and processing it, refining it, and delivering it to these nuclear power plants. there are also really significant water issues here. You know, it takes a lot of water to cool a nuclear power plant. So, you know, you're not really solving any issues or solving any problems by building nuclear power plants in northern Alberta. In fact, I would suggest that you're actually, you know, increasing the controversy about rapid tar sands development by even suggesting that, you know, you can use nuclear power to produce one of the world's dirtiest hydrocarbons.
Well, the way that you describe the process of extracting tar sands and the whole culture that is feeding makes it sound like a really bad idea, and it seems like a lot of people think that it's a pretty bad idea around the world, but why are the forces in Canada and in Alberta in particular so bent on exploiting the tar sands resources that they have?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First and foremost is the whole demand issue. You know, the United States is addicted to oil, as is Canada, as is most of the world, and you know, globalization as we know it is all based on the assumption that cheap oil will continue forever. Now, the tar sands really challenges that assumption. The full economics of tar sands production, though, hasn't really hit us because of the price volatility that we've seen recently with oil. So that's one whole issue. I mean, you know, there's this demand issue that's not going away, and political leaders don't want to deal with that. They don't want to really deal with the whole issue of decreasing demand through efficiency of one form or another. The next comes the issue, really, of the oil companies. The oil companies, you know, they've all invested in the tar sands because they, you know, in a world where peak oil is increasingly becoming reality, they see unconventionals as their future. So if you're an oil company and you don't want to make the transition to becoming an energy company, then you invest in the tar sands. So the tar sands is very much about oil security for oil companies. And for Canadians, you know, there's a lot of money attached to the development of this resource.
Well, you talk in your book about the first law of petropolitics, and I wonder if we can talk about what that is and how that is an indication of a direction that the politics is moving in Calgary in particular, and I guess Canada in general.
Well, petropolitics, it's an interesting phenomenon, and it's something we see in the Middle East, and it's something we see in any region where you see lots of hydrocarbon production. And it's simply, the principle is simply this, is that, you know, the resource can make a lot of money for government. And it's easy money for government. And over time, government then represents the resource as opposed to taxpayers because it becomes your central source of revenue. And Alberta is already a petro-state. Canada is well on its way to becoming a petro-state. And what we've seen over time is both Canada and Alberta increasingly representing the resource, as opposed to, you know, what's necessarily in the best interests of Canadians. It's really not in our best interest to develop this resource quickly because of its environmental and carbon liabilities, as well as its enormous fiscal liabilities. Yet we've done so, and we've done so because governments are thinking short term and are only thinking about the revenue and, you know, how much easier it is to run on oil revenue than it is to run on taxes and to make hard decisions about the future. So Canada, you know, has become a laggard on climate change issues. It has become a laggard on investing in renewable energy. And our international reputation has really gone down the drain as we've become a, you know, defender of high carbon fuels and increased oil exports to the United States.
Well, I found it interesting you compared Canada and Alberta in particular to other petro states, most of which are places that don't appeal as democracies, and I'll include the state of Texas as one of those. But you talk about,
yeah,
Texas, but also, of course, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, and you also mentioned Venezuela, which, of course, is a very large oil-producing state. And
yeah.
I guess I do consider Venezuela still to be a democracy. I haven't been there in a few years now, so I sort of have a sense things may be shifting. But one of the big things you talked about was the voter participation, and that in petro states, there's much less voter engagement, and people do not vote pretty much and are very disengaged with the political process. And I think that's true in all the states that you talk about, except for Venezuela, where, at least until recently, there was very, very high voter turnout. So I'm kind of curious about how you saw Venezuela fitting into this larger picture of petrostates.
Well, I would say Venezuela is very much part of this picture of petrostate. There are very few countries that have really dealt very well with, you know, this how do you deal with the revenue, and how do you avoid over time coming to represent the resource. Yeah, and Norway is one of the few countries that's done this. And I think when you look at Venezuela and you take a hard look at the politics of Venezuela, and even, you know, what Chavez has done with the resource, you have to come to the conclusion that, you know, that the media has in some ways been curtailed, that it's getting harder and harder to have open debate about many of these issues in Venezuela, that there is a lack of transparency about where the money is going and how it's being spent. And these are all issues that dog petrostates over time.
I would definitely say in Venezuela, what I did observe was the contradiction between there being some environmental awareness on the part of people within the Chavez administration, and yet they're so dependent on oil and on their population. I mean, I think gas cost 25 cents a gallon when I was there 4 years ago.
Yeah, they have among the cheapest gas.
And some of the worst gas guzzlers. I mean, and the air is really bad in Caracas. And so there's a lot of parts of this contradiction. And I was curious back then when I was there, you know, how are they going to resolve this issue? Because on the one hand, they are talking about trying to create sustainability and greening the country. And on the other hand, their entire revenue source is built on the exact opposite of those goals.
That's right. And they haven't really got a handle on that, you know. And I mean, the big issue for petrostate is you've got this massive amount of revenue, and so the first thing you do typically is you lower taxes, right? You make people feel warm and fuzzy about regimes they shouldn't feel warm and fuzzy about, and then you have this, you know, then your governments start to overspend. Venezuela is a classic case of this, as is Alberta and Canada, as is, you know, Russia, Nigeria. I mean, much of the Middle East, Abu Dhabi. And all of the problems that they have right now with their, you know, real estate crash are all a product of petropolitics and petrothinking, and you know, and the only way to deal with this issue is at the onset you have to have a national debate, and you have to recognize the perils of revenue from oil, and you have to say, you know what, we're going to take this money off the table, we're going to save it, it's going to go in a pension fund for future generations. And we're going to run on taxes. And if we run on taxes, then we will represent the people that are paying those taxes. You know, Thomas Friedman has said repeatedly, he's written very, I think, intelligently about this subject, is that, you know, there is no representation without taxation. And Alberta, like Texas, like Wyoming, like most Alaska, has very few taxes as a consequence of having all this oil wealth. And as a result, effectively over time, it comes to represent fewer and fewer of its people, and as a result, fewer and fewer of its people actually vote. We in Alberta, we have the lowest voter representation in all of Canada. So, and this is, you know, a phenomenon that has been well observed in the United States when Wyoming and Oklahoma and Louisiana and Texas and California were kind of the Saudi Arabias of their day. In the 20s and the 30s, where you had governors that stayed in power for much longer periods of time because they had control over enormous amounts of oil wealth, and you saw this kind of very open and massive manipulation of the political process, but just because of the oil dollars available to politicians.
And I think we're still seeing that in Texas, and probably in Louisiana.
Yeah, you still are seeing that in Texas, and you're very much seeing it in places like Wyoming as well.
Right. Well, I'm talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, who is the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. And if you're interested in learning more about this rather dirty subject, I highly recommend this book. And also, we've got a link on our webpage to Andrew's website, and you can not only learn more about his book, but also there's a lot of links on that page to other ways to become active. And so now that we've depressed everybody for the last half hour, let's talk a little bit about what people can do maybe to turn around and unhook us from this oil addiction that sees so much of North America and a good part of the world.
Well, I think there are a lot of really important things to do. The first is the United States has to have a general conversation about its energy supplies and resources. I mean, you didn't have the conversation in the 1970s when you switched to Saudi oil, and look at the political implications then for the United States as a result. So it's time for Americans to talk about oil and where they're getting it from, and what are the real costs of these oil imports. And then I think, you know, we've got to put a price on carbon. So, you know, everyone is part of this story. We're all playing a role in this story because of we're all sharers of we're all participants in this oil addiction. And I think a progressive carbon tax would you know, is the only way to convince most of us that, you know what, this behavior is not sustainable. It's not good for our economies in the long run. And we have to start thinking about relocalizing energy supplies. And there are a number of ways to do that. I think having a carbon budget in the United States is probably a really, really good idea. I think any investments you can make in renewables are extremely important. I think low-carbon fuel standards are another way to go, another signal to people that, look, you know, switching from bloody oil to dirty oil is not sustainable and is not going to make the United States resilient again. But, you know, it's going to be a long and tough debate. I've traveled throughout the United States, and I recognize quite clearly, you know, how dependent you are on oil supplies and how reluctant political leaders and religious leaders are to even raise the question that, you know, Americans are consuming too much. But, you know, one other area, too, I think this is really critical that has to be brought up, and it's certainly, I mean, a huge debate, has started, and that's relocalizing food production as a way to reduce your carbon footprint and also your energy footprint. So the more Americans can consume food locally and the less meat they can consume in that local diet, the more they will reduce their carbon footprint and their energy footprint. So there's lots of things that, you know, local people can do to get this conversation going and to get America going on a different path.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot more about local food in the coming weeks. In fact, it's one of the favorite topics of this show. So that is definitely one place where I think a lot of our listeners are very interested and informed about making some changes. Well, one last thing before I need to let you go. And I am talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, who's the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. Today is the 10th anniversary of the street demonstrations in Seattle to protest the WTO. And I'm wondering how the WTO, what relationship there's been between the WTO and the development of oil sands, and how even the WTO might be used as a mechanism to kind of slow down this development in the future.
Well, I guess the big battle in Seattle was really about the pace and scale of globalization and who was benefiting and who was losing out. And in many ways, the rapid development of the tar sands, which has been driven by market forces, is you know, really raises another debate, and that's about the globalization of unconventional hydrocarbons and whether or not the globalization of unconventional hydrocarbons or really high carbon oil is going to solve any problems or here for anybody. And that to me is the real issue being posed by this development. You know, we're accelerating climate change by getting addicted to unconventional hydrocarbons such as tar sands. We are becoming more locked into a high-priced energy economy the more addicted we become to this resource, and we're investing fewer and fewer dollars in renewables and alternative forms of energy by pouring billions and billions of bucks into unconventionals, you know, and we need to begin this conversation. Okay, well, you know, where does this end? When do we make the transition, and how can we make the transition if we remain locked into purchasing, high carbon fuels?
Well, I've been talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, who is the author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. And thanks very much for joining us. And this is, I think, a really important subject that we're just beginning to talk about enough down here in the United States. So I hope that you will help us continue this conversation.
Well, great. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for your interest, Barbara.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm. Go into the search bar and go Locus Focus and the date of the show you want to listen to, and it'll come up. And hopefully we'll have that all fixed in another few weeks, and you can go the old way. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Carlos Chavez. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening.
It was broken. The hills were smoking as the men withdrew. We stood on the cliffs and watched the ships slowly sinking to their rendezvous. They signed a treaty and our homes were taken. Loved ones forsaken. Try to raise a family, end up the enemy over what went down on the plains of Abraham. Acadian driftwood, gypsy tailwind, they call my home the land of snow. Canadian cold front.
February 13th, 2013. KBOO Station Navigator Report. We would like to thank everyone who donated to the Hats for the Homeless clothing drive. Your generosity to others less fortunate in our community is heartwarming. A special KBOO thanks to Zippity News for organizing this thoughtful event. Once in a Boo Moon is less than 2 weeks away, and tickets are going fast. Don't miss this amazing event featuring live music performed by KBOO hosts from the Folk Strip, music from the True Vine, Swing and Country, and the Noontime Jamboree. The evening includes desserts, a silent auction, and everyone who attends will be placed into a drawing to win two tickets to the entire popular Wintergrass Festival in Bellevue, Washington. For information and tickets to Once in a Boo Moon, visit kboo.fm. And we are still seeking a graphic artist to donate artwork for our 45th anniversary, posters, T-shirts, and other marketing collateral. Please contact Lynn Fitch, Station Navigator, 503-231-8032 or navigator@kboo.org. Thank you.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Coming up next is Health Watch. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Alma Midwifery, offering prenatal care, home and birth center birth, and mother-baby care for the first 6 weeks postpartum. Alma Midwifery provides relationship-based care with certified nurse and professional midwives, as well as childbirth education, yoga, and parenting classes. Located in the heart of Portland at Southeast 16th and Ankeny, or almamidwifery.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Dr. Gary Weiner. Dr. Weiner is a former writer and producer for public television who transformed his health through diet and nutrition and was motivated to then change his career and become a naturopathic physician and acupuncturist. In 2001, he co-founded Pearl Natural Health here in downtown Portland. And Dr. Weiner is here today on Health Watch to talk about complementary and natural approaches to inflammatory bowel disease, specifically ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, and also the program that he has developed at his clinic to serve the inflammatory bowel disease community here in Portland. If you'd like to join the conversation today on Health Watch, the number is 503-231-8187. Welcome back to Health Watch, Dr. Gary Weiner.
Thank you, David.
Well, let's very briefly just orient our listeners to what inflammatory bowel diseases are. I know that's not a short answer, but they're different than other digestive disorders in some crucial ways.
The inflammatory bowel diseases are often lifelong inflammatory diseases affecting the digestive system, called by researchers idiopathic, meaning that the cause is not known.
But a lot of people think it has an autoimmune component potentially,
yes,
at this point.
There are many unknown factors or a combination of factors that appear to trigger the body's immune system to produce an inflammatory reaction in the intestinal tract that continues without control and that results in inflammation of the intestinal wall and damage that leads to diarrhea and abdominal pain that is unbearable and intolerable.
And it does, for people who have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, there are some long-term risks for their health as well, aren't there?
Right. There's a high percentage, there's a between 3 and 4% increased risk for colorectal cancers. In children, there are very serious growth development issues in the Crohn's disease and dangers that can cause hospitalization in those cases that are uncontrolled.
And in conventional medicine, at this point, as you mentioned, they're not considered to have a known cause. So, from a naturopathic perspective, what are some of the theories around cause for the inflammatory bowel diseases, if there are theories?
Well, I think the theories of cause really are not specific to naturopathic medicine, because conventional medicine and research has isolated suspected causes, which and all the drug therapies are oriented around addressing those causes. There is no known cause, but there appears to be a dysbiosis or an abnormal